This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. This week, I want to welcome one of our newest friends of the Magic Word. That's Michael Wynn. Thank you very much, Michael, for becoming a friend of the Magic Word. It's thanks to you who make donations and others who make pledges from month to month and become patrons of this podcast that really help us keep going. We do have a lot of expenses that are associated with our domain charges, our server, with all of the hardware and software that we use. We try to continue to make this podcast not only great with the content that we offer, but also with the quality of the audio that you get to hear on the other end when you're hearing it through your earphones or in your car, on your speakers, wherever that you happen to hear this, trying to make this as good as possible. Anyhow, thank you very much. I appreciate it and welcome, Michael. And if anyone else is interested in becoming a friend of the Magic Word and finding out how that you can get some pretty cool perks along the way if you become a patron at different levels, so you just go to themagicwordpodcast.com and click on where it says become a friend of the Magic Word, and you can watch a video to see why that we need your support, and also that you can click on something to help us either through PayPal or through Patreon.com. This week, we happened to be at the 4F convention, that's Fechter's Finger Flicking Frolic in Buffalo, New York, and we had an opportunity to sit down with a longtime friend, Eric DeCamps. Now, we spoke with Eric a long time ago, and that was actually back in September of 2012, so that does go back a ways, and one of our very early episodes. And at that time, it was not a full hour, but it was just about a half hour or so, and he was just starting into his Pure Magic one-man show that he was taking on the road and going out to the West Coast to perform. Eric resides in the New York City area, so this was a bit of a haul for him, but he does this one-man show all over the world. Well, since then, he's continued to perform that and perfect it, and along the way, he has accumulated quite a few different accolades in which he is actually recognized by the magic community for what all he has done, not just for his one-man show, but he also received the Gold Medal of Excellence for Close-Up Magic by the Society of American Magicians, which I believe he's the only one who's received that like in 122 years. I also believe he was the guest of honor for the Salute to Magic they had for Assembly One. In fact, he is the Dean of Society of American Magicians, Parrot Assembly number one in New York City. And that was, he got that back in 2009. I believe he still is Dean there. He has won many other awards, and one of which was just given to him this year when we were at the 4F convention is that it was announced he will be the guest of honor for next year's convention. We just had our 51st, and next year will be our 52nd. He's been coming for a long number of years, and it's well-deserved. He gave his one-man show for us this last year for our 50th anniversary and just got a standing ovation. It was fantastic. This year, Paul Gertner gave his one-man show. Likewise, did just a great show, knocked it out of the park. He was amazing. But Paul has already been recognized as a guest of honor, and now it is Eric's turn, and I'm so glad that he is receiving that award. As I mentioned in the title for this week's episode of him being, he is the champion. I just think he is a champion performer, swell guy, great all-around magician, and if you haven't had a chance to hear from him, this is your opportunity to get to know Eric a whole lot better and learn a few things about how he developed his one-man show and some of the places he has worked in the past, which have included Mostly Magic and the Magic Townhouse, where he'd worked with Imam back at Mostly Magic back in the earlier days. And it's just kind of interesting to kind of hear the way things were, plus his association with Rene Levon. And if you don't know who Rene Levon is, I recommend you certainly go back and do some research on him. He has passed, so I'm not going to be able to get him on the podcast, but he is someone who was well known and is well worth your time investigating and perhaps buying some of his DVDs or his downloads to learn some of his routines. He is or was spectacular. And he was friends also then with Eric, and he talks about that this week. In fact, he talked about a lot of stuff, so I'm just going to let you hear all of this from Eric directly. So I'll just step out of the way and introduce my friend, Mr. Eric DeCamps, because he is the champion. He is the champion of the world. Anyhow, I think he's great here on The Magic Word.
Many years ago, we had a conversation with my guest here today because he was doing a one-man show. And since then, he's continued to do that one-man show. And we're going to talk a little bit, if not a lot, about doing one-man shows and working theaters and other kinds of things like working conventions and being a part-time professional and living in New York City and traveling and doing all the really cool stuff that he does. And I don't know where to begin other than saying, please welcome my friend today, Mr. Eric DeCamps. Hello there, Eric.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Good to see you then as well. Yeah. I remember, by the way, Renee Levon, we were at an SAM convention and you were like his interpreter, I think.
No, that was the cameraman. I was the camera director. What happened was it was 1993 at the SAM convention in New Orleans.
Yeah.
And they had booked Renee to perform and they had Tina Lerner and do the translation, but they knew that I knew him so well and that I knew his act so well.
And that's what's important.
So I was there with the cameraman and told him when to pull and when to pan, when to go, because I knew what the highlight.
Yeah.
And he did two shows and they were about, I think, an hour and 15 or an hour or 90 minutes long. And he just rocked it, man.
That was an amazing show that I'll remember the rest of my life. And it was Tina that was actually interpreting.
Correct.
And but what I remember then is how smoothly that the video operation of that was, because typically when you go to a magic convention, and even if you have other magicians, they don't know the act. Right. You know the act because you knew Renee and you had worked
with him.
Yeah,
and I had studied him and we met in 1991 in Lausanne, Switzerland. I was competing. I was representing the Society of American Magicians as their
FISM?
Entrance. Yeah, for FISM. And I went there and performed, and I was in the contest. And that was a whole crazy experience. But that's where I got to see Renee Levon perform. And the beauty of that, I mean, the thing was, I had seen him on video.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, they were on VHS tapes that he did back in the 1980s.
Yeah.
And I'm
yeah.
like, oh, this guy's great. But it's nothing compared to seeing him live.
I have to agree.
To see him live and sitting with 2,000 magicians, he's doing close up, they're projecting the thing. And he did the breadcrumbs. And I had been in magic for 20 plus years at that point. And I thought I understood magic. And I'm watching him do the breadcrumbs. And there's no tell. I couldn't follow it. I don't understand. I'm going like, I don't understand this. And I'm sitting with my buddy, Darwin Ortiz, God rest his soul. I'm sitting next to him and I lean over to Darwin. I go, do you know what this guy, because I think I know what he should be doing, but it's not, and I don't get it. And then Darwin goes, I don't know either. I says, well, wherever this guy's going, I'm following him, man.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went backstage. I never do this. Scott, I never do this. I don't like to bother artists after this. And I had to meet him. So I went backstage and introduced myself.
In Lausanne.
In Lausanne, yeah. Lausanne, right. Backstage. I snuck my way backstage and he's walking around doing his thing. And I walk up to him and I go, Mr. Levon. I spoke to him a little bit in Spanish. And I got all choked up because he affected me in a way that no magician has affected me before, in close-up magic, mm-hmm. I'm saying.
Nor sense, really, I guess.
No, because it was an emotional thing. I mean, magic is an intellectual thing. I mean, you're breaking the fourth wall all the time, and your conflict, you know, all storylines should have, a good storyline should have some sort of conflict. And mm-hmm. a natural conflict is breaking the laws of nature, right? Mm-hmm. Making things pass to another, cutting and restoring something, ripping something apart.
Right.
Finding and, you know, doing, breaking the laws of nature. And watching him do that breadcrumb trick was just, and the way he affected me on an emotional level. I mean, music affects you on emotion. It's passive. You sit down, you listen to music, it affects you emotionally.
Definitely.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And me too. Mm-hmm. But his story, it was just a revelation. And it changed my perception on performing magic on a different level. And I think I've grown because of that. And many times I think about when I'm working on a piece, I ask myself, not that I want to imitate him, because I really don't. I want to be myself, because I think that's what we all bring. We have to bring ourselves. The audience wants to get to know you when you do a show, when you do a performance piece. But I always ask myself, one of the things is that, how would Renee would approach this? And what could I learn? And what would he say? And he was just wonderful.
That's true. It's like artists. I mean, they don't come, well, you come to see Rembrandt, but also Rembrandt or any other artist is the culmination of so many artists before them that whom they have studied to become who they are now. So you can see influences of that.
Without a doubt.
Yeah. And that's what you're telling me is that you recognized maybe for the first time that magic could be art.
At a very high level. He was an artist. Tamari's a completely different 180 style, but again, he's art.
Mm-hmm.
Ascanio, and I'm saying any of these Spanish magicians only because they opened my eyes. I mean, in the United States, it's a little bit jokey, our styles are different, but these guys, the Spanish school of magic is just on a different level.
I want to talk about that a little bit then too, but going still sticking with Rene Lavant. I remember you or someone was talking about how that his storyline was so emotional that it cannot translate to English in the same way it's said in Spanish.
Correct.
In other words, that I wish I knew exactly what he was saying because of the emotional ties. Kind of like if I'm translating this to you, it's like, yeah, you get it. It's okay. But it's much, I'm getting goosebumps just thinking about, you know, well, but yeah, it must
too.
Be.
And I'll tell you, in 1996, I got a call from Gustavo Loria. Gustavo Loria is like the David Copperfield of Colombia.
Okay.
And he was putting together this conference called FLASOMA 97.
Yeah, sure.
Right. So it's basically like the South American FISM, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they have a show and everything else, and he was doing it in Bogota, and he said, I'd like to hire you to come and present. And I'm like, well, you know, I don't know, you know, whatever. And he goes, well, this is the lineup, and we got Rene Lavant. And that clicked it to me because I said, now I get a chance to see Rene in his native language without a translator.
Mm.
Because anytime you use a translator, it throws your
timing
off.
There's a break.
It throws the timing off.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Wow.
So I said, this is a great opportunity. So I said, okay, I'll do it. I want to do it. And so we fly down. I fly down, and that's a whole nother thing. I never experienced flying down to Colombia before. It was interesting. And the town is, and I have a lot of stories, but I got to see him. They rented a theater because they were doing public shows, close-up public public shows for the close-up. He hired he rented a movie theater,
mm-hmm.
and he had them perform on the floor because the house is very raked.
Yeah.
So they could do that. And they sold tickets to the general public, and it was part of the convention. If you're part of the convention, you can go see the show.
Mm-hmm.
And they had Alan from Argentina as an MC. These are some of the names. I don't remember them all. Fernando Chiops is a great magician. Aldo Colombini, God rest his soul. He was great because Alan can, Aldo could perform in like seven languages, that guy. And they had Carl Cloutier, and
wow.
I'm sure I missed somebody else. And I forgot.
That was the first FLASOMA?
Yeah, no, I don't think it was the first. It was one of the early ones,
okay.
Yes. And then Rene Lavant. And I got to see Rene. And I sat there, and I watched him, and he came out on the stage, walks out, comes out. This is unbelievable. He walks out in the typical Rene style, you know, very elegant, and he comes out, tells a little story, goes down, does a version of the breadcrumbs very fast, not even the full, just does one card trick, stops, gets up, and finishes with a poem. And the crowd went bonkers.
Yeah.
They're throwing roses at him.
Really?
And I swear to God,
what?
They gave him a big bouquet of roses. And I'm like, oh my God. I mean,
he was a rock star.
He was a rock star. He was a rock star. And it was such an honor to see that and experience it. And that was worth the trip. Just to see that.
Getting to know him, did you find out more about his life and his early life? People have asked me, did he lose an arm early in life?
Yes, he lost it, I think it was around 10. He was on a bicycle, mm-hmm. and a truck hit him, and they had to amputate his right arm from here down.
From below the elbow.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what, because we didn't really talk about it, except he told me the truth. And,
but did he do magic before then? And then he had two hands, so he thought, okay, my career's over, or did he start as therapy?
Well, he was a kid. He's 10 years old.
Yeah, but there are a lot of kids who start young, too. But.
And but so he had to learn how to do magic with one hand,
mm-hmm.
with his left hand. And, you know, I remember having a conversation with Tamari's. I said, we were talking about Rene, and... Tamari's says to me, I was asking, who's the best card man you've ever seen? Well, he said to me, well, I think the best card man is Rene Lavant. I go, why? Because he had to reinvent card magic to be able to do with one hand, because he had to reinvent everything for his one hand. And I said, yeah. And there was a time, because I remember talking to Damaris, one of the times that he went to Colombia, one of the first early trips to Colombia. Oh, South America, excuse me. I don't know if it was Colombia. I don't recall the country. And he wanted to go see Rene, and Rene was doing a lecture or doing a show someplace. Mm-hmm. And Tamaris went. And this was a period of time where Rene did not want to know about magicians. He was not interested in hanging out with magicians. He was not, and this is, of course, all what Tamaris told me. And so Tamaris went to see him, and he says it was a column. Maybe it was a show, I don't know what it was, and I don't recall right now. And Tamaris very quietly got walked into the room and was hiding behind a column, just to watching him, because they didn't want Rene to be to see him or see that there were a magician that hit his caliber was watching him. And eventually, Rene saw him and then called him forward, and then they became good friends.
Wow.
And but he did not, at that time, he didn't want to socialize.
But you think of that as because he wanted to dedicate his time and energy to learning rather than being influenced by other magicians? In other words, he kind of had his influences, I'm sure, before.
Right.
Plus, he was having to reinvent on his own, and he didn't want other outside things to bother him. Mm-hmm. And I mean, he came into magic, I say magic, to associating with magicians later in life, as you're saying. But it was only after he had reached a certain level that he was comfortable, I guess.
Well, I think part of the issue, too, is that he didn't want his stuff to be seen and be copied and stuff like that. He was very much wanted to be an original. And I think
there are not many one-handed magicians who are out there. They'd be copying.
But one of Rene's biggest heroes, and because he told me this, was Slidini. Mm-hmm. Because when he went in, I think it was his 64, I think it was, early 60s, where Rene went to the Ed Sullivan Show. Remember that? The old
I
Ed
do.
Show.
Yeah.
And he was there, and he did a version of McDonald's Aces on the show with his one hand, and he stayed with Slidini. And when I translated for him, when he did a lecture on Long Island, he did a whole homage to Slidini. And it was, and he would tell, you know, he tells the story of how he stayed with Slidini and how he stayed at his house and that Slidini would cook for him every night. Mm-hmm. And he just loved Slidini.
I know that Tamaris is a good cook. Isn't that right?
I've been at meals with him, but only at a restaurant.
Okay, but not at his home?
No, I haven't been to his home in Spain.
So you haven't gone over like to Spain with like where Gary Plants and I know some of the guys go over there from time to time.
I've been only to Spain once. I did the Ascanio Memorial in 2010. I was hired by Miguel Gomez, who is one of the greatest card men I've ever met in my life. And a sweetheart. He invited me to go attend and to do a performance. Mm-hmm. And that was an interesting experience. It was a great experience. Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Why was that interesting? What was that?
Because I was sweating bullets because I had to present in Spanish.
Oh, okay.
I didn't feel comfortable, even though my parents are Dominican and I don't speak Castellano. They remember it's like five different languages in Spain. Mm-hmm. They're all Spanish because they're from Spain, but they're different. And, you know, my parents are Dominican and I speak Dominican. And
I know Basque, for example, is a completely different language.
And it's just different. So I was just sweating bullets and I didn't want to make a faux pas, mm-hmm. you know? So, but I rehearsed it and worked it and they had to translate it for me when I got stuck. You know, if I got stuck with a word, I'd go to him. And then I did it in English because, again, I'm so used to working in English. My timing, mm-hmm. my rhythm is all in English. Mm-hmm. So if I have to stutter to get a, and I have to think of a word, it throws me off. So I'd rather just flow. As you know, being a performer, everything has got to get into body memory. You want to get into body memory to get a thing. And you can't worry about technique when you're presenting. You have to get that technique down so that you can forget it.
It's second nature.
It.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's like breathing.
And you're concentrating on the audience and reactions.
That's what you really want to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're going to have your script. You're going to have what you're going to say. I mean, you can be very scripted. You can be an outline. Mm-hmm. and play and work the crowd, which I'm doing more now than before, working a crowd, because I think when you're working, you got to be in that moment. I'm sure you've heard of the term being in the moment. Well, I didn't understand that. And I was, when I was doing my run at the Metropolitan Room, I had hired, when I got hired to do a series of runs at the Metropolitan Room in New York City, I hired Bob Fitch to help me as a director with all his knowledge on Broadway and theater and that.
A Tony Award winner.
and also he was a magician and a great magician. I mean, Bob's coin work is second to none. I mean, it was phenomenal. So I knew that he could help me. So I hired him. I asked him to help me and he said yes. And we would meet every Saturday at 8 o'clock in the morning at the nightclub, because I worked out a deal to get into the theater, into the nightclub, because I wanted to rehearse in the space that I was going to eventually perform in, because that way I knew the room and felt comfortable in the room. So we would meet there and spend 4 hours a day every Saturday working on my show. And one of the things that he told me was, can you, you got to be in the moment. And I didn't really understand that until one of my shows that I did, one of the last shows of the run, where we had a sold out audience, the show was going great, and it was like, how do I put this? You become like one consciousness. This is going to sound flaky, but it's true. You become one consciousness with a group. It's like what they call a beehive mentality, I guess. You're in, and you just know, your audience knows where you're going, you know where they're going, and you can communicate on a different level. And everything you say is just,
they're with you, is what you're saying.
They're with you 100%, and they're well connected with you. And it's such a such a symbiotic relationship, and it's just great.
It's hard to get to that level, obviously. Bizarre. And it's fairly rare because of different people's mentality and the makeup, obviously, the audience, whether they've been drinking or not, and their educational level, and all kinds of things as to, you know, getting the right group together at the right time and place and for the stars to align. Not that it, I'm trying to make it sound like it's a once in a lifetime opportunity, but, you know, that's what we're trying to always create, is that beehive mentality kind of a thing.
Yeah, you
I like
really
that.
Want
like
to connect that. No, it's like that the hive mentality. Right?
Yeah.
That's a better term. And so you get that connection, and it's really I can't explain to people that are non-performers the type of internal energy that you're burning when you're performing.
Oh my gosh!
And it's like you.
I think
sweating.
I lose 5 pounds at the end of the show.
Right? It's unbelievable, right? Yeah. And you walk off and you're exhausted, but you feel full of life, and that kind of feeling is rare.
That's why I think that performers are alcoholics, and I'm not talking necessarily about magicians, but you know how like jazz magicians. The point is that they're finished with their gig for the night, and it's like 1 in the morning or 2 or whatever. And
you're jazzed up.
You know, it's like,
I
can't
go. Juiced up. Yeah,
you are. I can't go to sleep right now. And so I need something to bring me down. And so it's either drugs or alcohol sometimes, if they're doing it, you know, night after night after night. And it's like, I've got to do something, and they fall into a bad situation. But magicians are the same from the standpoint that after a show, you are on a mental high because you are physically exhausted.
Right.
You're spent.
Not only that, you're full of adrenaline.
But yeah, exactly. That perspiration's been replaced with adrenaline. You know,
right. And it's really nice when you can, you know, it takes me a while to put together a show. And when I do that show, I like taking the audience through a journey.
Sure, that's as you should.
You know, I like that. I mean, I could do strolling magic. I like doing strolling magic.
Yeah.
But it's not as artistically rewarding as doing a show and going
through.
They're
short shows. Each thing is really a short show because you're trying to bring them through.
But it's not the same experience. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's not the same experience of taking them and showing them different things and aspects and how things influence you so that they get to know you at the end of the night. They go, here's an interesting character, this guy. You know,
I have talked about this, like whenever I lecture about restaurant magic, about approaching a table, and the two most difficult things for most sterling magicians is approaching a group and leaving a group, because you don't want to leave a group that you have now got on your sides, because now I've got to do this all over again. You know, it's like once I've approached it and I've kind of got them on my side and things are going well and they're eating it up and they're laughing. It's like, why would you want to leave a group that has accepted you? Well, sorry, time's up. I got to go to the next one and start all over again.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. No. Oh, and I get it. And here's the deal. When I was a kid, I was very shy and reserved. I couldn't mingle with people.
That's why you like Batman?
Yeah. Yeah. I was like, yeah, I was here. Yeah, please. And
hope we have time to talk about this.
I can't believe you pulled that one out of your pocket. So it's very interesting because I had trouble communicating with people and any performing art, any art form. It's about communication. I don't care if it's sculpture, painting, a dance, or whatever. It's about communicating with your audience, right? Mm-hmm. So I had trouble breaking the ice and walking up to people. And I was very shy. You go to a party, I'd be in the corner or whatever. So when I started getting into magic slow, and I never knew I would be this involved with magic, but and slowly working my way into magic, I started finding that I had to force myself to talk to people. And doing strolling magic and doing bar mitzvahs and doing private events and stuff like that, weddings, whatever, it forced me. And it was always difficult for me in the past to get that first table because, you know, get over that hump, that fear, whatever you want to call it. And then now I have a style that I know how to approach a table cold and welcome everybody because now I'm much more mature and I'm much more confident to do that, going and introducing myself to people. And it forced me to do that. And what forced me to do it was that I would get hired. And then I'd have to go into my head and say, I'm getting paid for this. These people expect me to do this. You got to get your butt up and get over there and talk to those people and show them magic. Mm-hmm. And that forced me and that helped me to come out of my shell.
And so you find that you could do that so much more easy now.
Yeah, I find it easier for me now. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm still kind of shy when I'm not performing. Mm-hmm. But if I'm performing, then I normally don't have a problem.
I don't think it's unusual. I think that if you talk with magicians, you'll find that inherently a lot of magicians who have come from that kind of mental background when they were, well, they've talked about before, like when you're in school and you're trying to get attention. And so you're kind of shy and thinking, okay, well, I can break out a little bit and I can show some pretty cool things to my fellow students and they'll accept me. And so because I don't know what else to do, I'm not a good athlete or I can't be a cheerleader, you know, for male or female, whatever it is, they're trying to get some acceptance. And they maybe were wallflowers until suddenly it's like, hey, this kid can do a pretty cool trick. Have you seen him do this or heard of this? And so I think that's not unusual for magicians to have a shy or demure side.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah. Because before getting into magic, I used to like model making. I used to buy the model kits, paint
them. There you go.
And that's introverted. That's
exactly
a very isolated, you know, and you're doing your own thing. So this brought me out of my shell. Mm-hmm. And now I'm part of this community, which I have to tell you, I'm having such a blast. We're here at 4F in 2024. Mm-hmm. This has been a wonderful thing. I mean, last year we finally got back together after what, 3 years?
Yeah.
I'm not.
Yep.
Three years. Now we're back together and we're having a great, and I'm having a blast with it, seeing everybody, seeing the shows. You know, we just finished watching a show now with Javi Benitez and he was awesome.
Yeah, you had a bunch of really cool ideas. I want to go back for a minute. I was asking whether that you had eaten with Juan Tamaris. Actually, I was confused. It was Slagdini, because you mentioned that then also about how that he and Renee, I guess, would eat. I heard that Slagdini liked to cook spaghetti and pasta. I remember Bill Wish telling me about he would go over and he would fix him dinner all the time.
Yeah, the thing about Slagdini, I used to work a nightclub back in the 80s, early 80s.
Imams?
Imam's place, mostly magic.
I know all about you, man.
Yeah, yes, you do. And
about Ric Flair and the wrestling and everything.
Oh, man, don't even get into that. So that's really funny. And the thing is about Slidini is that he mostly magic, for the first 5 years that I worked there, Slidini would do the second half of the show.
No kidding.
On Friday nights.
Friday, I can't imagine going in and seeing Slidini work at a club.
I was great. I got to see him every Friday night.
Yeah.
And you know, there was nights that he was just unbelievable.
Sure.
I mean, remember, he was in his mid-80s at that point. Mm-hmm. And he was just...
Was he a nightclub act or was he doing a close-up?
He was doing close-up. This is what Imam... So Imam had two versions of Mostly Magic. The first version, the original version, was a 62-seat amphitheater, mm-hmm. small little amphitheater, very raked house. You worked low so you can see the tabletop and you can do any type of close-up magic you wanted. And so it was perfect for Slidini's magic because mm-hmm. it's, you know, you got the table here and you got people up here and you're looking down.
Looking down, yeah.
Then he renovated it around the late 80s, around 88. He closed the place for about 2 weeks and gutted the place and rebuilt it into like a cabaret, added a kitchen, and he had wait staff and tables, and it was more of a cabaret situation, mm-hmm. which was good for me because at that time, he would have a lot more acts come in, different acts. It was mostly magic, aptly titled, mm-hmm. because they had a comedian, a juggler, a singer. So you'd have these really good artists performing. And now you're on the same bill with a Pamela Smith who could sing her heart out. You're on the same bill with these national comics, mm-hmm. you know. Now you had to up your game. You had to up your game because if your game wasn't up to par, you looked horrible against these guys. So I would sweat, you know, and then, you know, you start doing this whole thing and you start building up. And it was great because they also on Tuesday nights, you had open mic night and I'd go there on open mic night and work on a piece. Like I was working at the time, I remember specifically the Coins and Cylinder and I wanted to do the Coins and Cylinder. So I would go on Tuesday nights. Every first week, it was kind of.
You've been working on that since the 80s?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Hmm. Oh, yeah. Late 80s.
That's why it's so brilliant.
Oh, thanks.
Such a perfect piece.
Oh, thanks. And I spent a lot of time. That's a very difficult trick to sell to a lay audience, mm-hmm. you know, to come up with an interesting hook.
I thought of it from a lay audience standpoint. I have to look at it
as a magician. I had to do it for lay audiences. Yeah. And I had to make it engaging.
Sure.
That was really important. It's not easy. And
so you went on Tuesday and you were doing...
And the first week, it's kind of sucked. But I didn't care because it was just... a bunch of comedians that you're doing. It's like, who cares? You're not getting paid and you're doing the thing and it's fine. And then next week I made notes, a little bit better. Following week, a little bit better. And then eventually, okay, I think it's good enough to put it in my performance in the weekends. Mm-hmm. And that's what I did. And then I would slowly creep it in. And then finally I got it to the point where it really started to gel and I can get it to work. And I had, you know, my lines, I developed lines for the vanishes and stuff like that. Yeah.
That is important, the way that magicians will continue to work on an act, the way that comedians and others have, you know, work around town, just wherever there's an opportunity to perform. It's flight time, you know, basically.
Correct.
And so
one air time, yeah.
Trying to get that stage time. And if somebody's living in Sioux City, Iowa, you may not have as much of an opportunity to go out, you know, to, I don't know, maybe the Ramada has an open mic night or something, you know, or it might be some other places. But I think my point is, I don't think it's easy today as may have been back in the mm-hmm. day. And I mean, New York is a larger place, obviously,
right.
where they still have some places, but they probably still don't have the venues now that they did even 10 years ago, let alone 20 or 30
years
ago.
It's different.
You know?
It's different. I don't know what the guys are doing. I mean,
Harrison Greenbaum, for an example, you know, is all over town. He goes from one to another. He's always working and trying to out new lines and stuff.
He's great.
Yeah.
He's very, very funny kid. But he's a crossover performer. Mm-hmm. With that, I mean that he can go into the comic strip and perform. He can go to Gotham Comedy Club and perform. I have certain pieces that I could do in those venues.
Yeah.
I can do my egg bag routine, which is very strong. And I'm going to do a piece tomorrow night here at the thing, which I developed specifically to promote my show. And
you do Dean Dill's box there?
I did it in my show. It's part of my show, right. And but I mean, I needed a piece to go on open mic night at the Metropolitan Room mm-hmm. and perform to promote my show on weekends. Mm-hmm. So I worked on a routine that I'm going to do tomorrow night, which is I've always done rope magic. I've always loved rope magic. I mean, the sensational and rope-sational, those are staples that I've been doing since I was a kid. Mm-hmm. But I needed to develop a routine with that as a basis, and you'll see it tomorrow night. But it's, again, tomorrow night I'm going to be doing stuff that I do for lay people.
We can talk about this because, I mean, by the time this airs, I mean, nobody's going to hear this until after tomorrow.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, it's a rope routine, and it's great. And I think it's great. It's funny. I got an interesting hook. And you'll tell me what your thoughts are after you see it. Mm-hmm. I mean, you may, I don't know, hopefully you'll like it. But I think it's funny. It's a different kind of an angle to doing rope magic.
Is it there again, like we were talking about, where you take different influences of
I take different influences. I have some original stuff in there, and I have stuff that's foundational. Of course, it all goes back to a genius by the name of George Sands.
Mm, he was.
I mean, that guy was ridiculous.
I only met him a couple of times. And
he was a character.
Yeah, he was a character.
He was a character. I've only got to see, I remember when I finally got to see a video of him from a film that a friend of mine took for the Tannen's Jubilee.
He lectured for us in Houston many years ago.
And it's like, this voice, it's just bizarre. I mean, it was just such a New York voice. You know, this real Brooklynese voice, you know, and he gets up and does, and I'm going like, who the heck would have thought of doing this the way he did it? His technique, his concept on how to do it, because everyone else would cut, and he just did that ropesational thing, changed magic. I mean, you'll see the routine tomorrow.
Yeah, yeah, looking forward to that.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting.
And so as far as the one-man show and working your way towards that, was that a goal that you were working for, Eric, for a long time?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was always a dream to be able to do a show, and I've had a couple of versions
of it.
You've
had a goal, and I think that's important.
Well, what I would do back then, back in the day, I started working Tannen's Jubilees like in the early 80s. I think it was 84, 85 was the first time I worked. So every year I'd work on a piece. And remember, I had a big advantage. I'm working at a nightclub every weekend. So I would work on a piece to present and debut
weekly.
To do a Tannen's Jubilee.
Okay. Yeah.
Because I would help run the convention.
The Jubilee. Yeah.
And I would, every year I would, I was always hired to go back.
Kutchner's.
But I would do a new routine. So every, and then that routine, if it went well, I would then put that in and then add that and like little building blocks. And I would work on them. And then I would also hone them at the nightclub. So it was a great experience. And then I put together a show. And then since that show, I've changed it. And now I do a show called Pure Magic, a performance of contemporary conjuring, which could be a 75-minute show, a 70-minute show, or a 90-minute show.
Oh, okay.
I mean, because I can plug things in and out. But it's between 75 and 80 is where I like to be. And the latest piece that I were put into the show is my version of the and my interpretation of the Rising Cards. And because that was a problem that I've been working with since the mid-80s, and I could never come up with a method that worked well for me. I couldn't do it. But because I had specific... I got obsessed with the Hooker Rising Cards.
I can see why.
You know, I got obsessed with it. And I was reading it and studying it. And I studied everything.
Talked to Johnny Gunn, I guess.
I spoke to Johnny Gunn, and I might as well have been speaking to a statue because he was not giving up anything.
Okay. Curious about that. Okay.
All right. So I missed it in 93. I missed it in 93. But when I found, this is a funny story. When I found out he was going to reprise it in 2007, and I found out about it late. Okay. I found out like in April, and I'm like, what the hell?
How can I get there to see this?
I pulled every string I could and finally got myself in. And I got to see it once, right? You were there.
I was not there. I've just heard about it. I mean, I know.
Oh, dude, you have no idea how incredible this thing is.
It's what everybody tells me. I feel like that's the one thing I've missed.
And I'm thinking, it's this one little nugget that I can get out of watching that I can possibly use. Because I had studied everything. I had notes from all these people that saw it in 93.
Yeah.
All these people that were there that took copious notes of what they saw. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I have all their personal, and I'm studying this. I'm reading all the magazine articles. You know, the Paul Bearer's Review, John Mulholland dedicated a whole issue to it and had every single, so I knew it.
Yeah.
I knew it here. It was all there and I could see it as a movie. So now I'm sitting in the audience and you only get one shot.
Yeah.
You get one shot because the rules were you can come and see the show, but you can only see it once.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You couldn't come in, you couldn't pay to get in. All right. These are the rules. Now, listen to this, Scott. Now, I'm stewing, right? I got all this energy in me going, I'll get to see. All right. We're going to do the performance. When the curtain comes open, no one's allowed to talk. If you talk, we stop the show, we close the curtains, and you leave.
Wow.
We're not doing it. If you stand up during the performance, we shut the curtains, close up, everyone leaves. If you hear any noise, and all these rules. Now, I'm 30-some-odd years, and I got that, and I'm like, I can't, and I know... At one point, he's going to borrow a deck from the audience, and it's any card named rises out of a borrowed deck.
Yeah.
A borrowed deck. And now I got all this stuff. And I already, I had Jay Marshall's notes on it when he saw it in 93. Mm-hmm. I had Larry Jennings' notes from 93. And this is 2007. So I had studied. I go, okay, this is what's going to happen here. This is going to happen here. I don't know what phase, because he didn't do the full show. He only did 34 minutes, about 40 minutes of it.
Yeah.
So now they do the thing. And I got all this pressure on me, man. I got David Regal sitting to my left. We're sitting way in the back and we're watching. And I'm going nuts because I'm going to see this dream that I've been dreaming about.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
He does the whole thing and he's going, and there's Johnny doing the thing and I'm watching it and I'm analyzing it because now I only got one shot. So I can't enjoy it just as a spectator.
Yeah.
I want to analyze it and enjoy it at this. I want to join the fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
That joining the fantasy is very important to
me. Right.
But I only have one shot. So I maybe there's one little nugget, right? So I'm watching this thing and I'm sitting there and I'm watching it. And now it comes to the point where Johnny walks to the edge and goes, I need to borrow a deck. Scott, I lose my freaking mind. I go inside because I had brought this pack of cards that were not very...
Hadn't been used much?
Right, not only have been used much, but you don't see them too much. They were at the time were bicycle vintage cards.
Oh.
And they had just reprinted them. So I took out a specific deck that I knew he couldn't switch.
Yeah.
He's not going to switch it.
Right.
Well, now, like a complete idiot, I jump up with my hand. I got a deck. I got a deck. All 50 people turn around and start looking at me, and they're throwing visual daggers at me.
It's because like, we're going to be kicked out.
If they close that curtain, they're going to, there's torches and pitchforks are coming after
That's
me.
Right.
Right?
That's right. That's
right. They're coming. And I'm like, holy crap. I said, oh, sorry. And I said, oh my God, what am I doing? And you see Jim Steinmeier on the side. Calm down, Eric, calm down, it's okay. And I'm like, I'm going like, what did I do? And you see Regal go like, he's not with me.
Yeah, don't know the guy.
Right, so they come out and they take my deck, he does the thing, any card named by a different spectator rises out of the pack, under the dome, whatever, and then they give me back my deck. And I got my deck, and I found what I needed to find in my deck, which I knew was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So I got some of the work, but unfortunately, there's nothing there that's practical.
Mm-hmm.
There is nothing in that whole presentation. It's beautiful to watch.
Sure.
And... you know, it's like trying to learn Slidini's magic from a book. Slidini's magic is brilliant. But if you don't see that timing, there's no way you're going to pick. You can't pick
timing. It is all about
timing,
isn't it? That's a good point.
You cannot pick up timing from a written page.
Mm-hmm.
You can't.
Well, I remember in Tom Mulica's book that he actually had the timing written on. That's the only book I'd ever seen. Yeah, it had a clock on there.
Yeah, clock, because that was his whole show.
Yeah.
But it's the timing of the motion when you move.
I see what you mean.
You know, when you do the hang, ping, ching. I never took a lesson from Slidini, but I studied him profusely.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, not to pat myself on the back, but I do the hang, ping, ching, the classic hang, ping, ching, like Slidini.
Mm-hmm.
I do it really, really well.
Uh-huh.
And only because I watched him every time I could see him on television. And I studied those, and that timing of moving the hands, the coordination of the hands, the beat is very important. And so, again, you can't study it. So you don't see the timing of the cards and the rising of the cards, because what I would read it in paper on the printed page, it happened instantaneously.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen instantaneously. Seven of clubs. Okay. All right, here it comes. You know what I'm saying? Because it takes a while. And to think about this miracle that happened during a period of time, there's no electronics.
Mm-hmm.
Electricity is still fresh. That's still new. I mean, it was 1915 when he came up with the thing. So it was pretty amazing. It was pretty amazing. But again, there was nothing there that was practical in any way, shape, or form than the conditions that I want to perform. So it took me a long time. And then about 5 years ago, I sat down and go, listen, I'm not getting any younger. My hair's getting grayer. Either you're going to come up with something or not. And then I really put my nose to the grind, worked out a lot of different little methods and stuff. And then I presented it last year.
Yeah.
I presented it here.
Here
I mean,
before
I presented it before
yes.
that. And the biggest shocker about that, I didn't realize how powerful that trick is.
It's a great trick.
No, it's so powerful. It surprised me from lay people because under the conditions that I do it under and isolate it and it rises, I had people scream, literally lay people, just a room full of lay people. Scream, oh, Jesus, you know? And I, that's when I knew, I said, oh my God, this is much more powerful than I thought it was. So that's why I changed. What happened was, you got a minute? I'll tell you this story. So what happened was, when I was working on it and I finally came up with the methodology and the staging that I wanted it, I was in my home and I called my wife, Celeste, who's got the patience of a saint. I said to her, you got to see this thing. And I make the card rises and it just rise. And she looks at it and she looks at me and she goes, that's a closer. And I said, what are you talking about, woman? I said, that's not a closer. That's a middle piece. The box, my spirit box, my interpretation of Dean's box. That's a closer. Mm-hmm. And she says to me, no, that's great. And that has been your closer, but that's your closer. And I said, come on, lady, you know what you're talking about. But I'm going to do it as an encore piece because I'll do the box and I'll do it as an encore piece. If it doesn't go great, they still like me. They had this whole full show and everything went well. And if this doesn't go over well, it doesn't feel so bad. It turns out the freaking thing killed.
Yeah.
And then I said, oh my God. And it's perfect as an encore for me, for my show, because it's whole thing. And then I stop and everyone gives me.
It's hard to follow the box.
It is very hard. That silly box. It's not silly.
No, it's not. In the presentation, I mean, I love that. And I was working with it for a while then as well. But after you saw yours, I put it up. I haven't touched it
since
I've seen yours. It's like, that's the ultimate.
I really appreciate it because that was a godsend when I came up with the storyline for it.
Yeah.
And once I had the storyline for it, I had redesigned the box because the box that I have is not what it was sold.
Mm-hmm.
I had that made for me. And I had it made to my specs.
Did Lupe make it?
No, this is way before. I was surprised when I found out Lupe was making them again. And I looked at it, and she does, she does beautiful woodwork.
She does.
But I had already gotten mine, because I got this back in around 2000. So mine is about 24 years old, and there's only one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I redesigned it, and I came up with my thing, because it had to fit my storyline.
Sure.
That's the whole thing, and I can sell it. I couldn't sell what it sold because it's too modern. It's great, great box, but it's a little bit too modern
for
what I do.
Yeah.
Mine had to be an antique.
Mm-hmm.
It had to look old,
mm-hmm.
and that's what I wanted. And it had to look a little beat up.
And so moving towards your one-man show then as well, again, when we had talked before, you were just, I think you were doing a convention, you were doing a cruise ship, and then I think you were performing it maybe once or twice in the LA area, in or around the castle?
Yes, what I did was Sean Farquhar hired me to do the TAOM, and his TAOM was on one of his ships because he was working ships.
That was a PCAM.
PCAOM. I said TAOM. Oh my God. Yeah, it's a PCAOM. I'm sorry.
And we did a great job of setting up a room for you at the TAOM. That was
the
Eric DeCamps theater.
Yeah, that's right. That's the best room. I have 175 seats.
Yeah.
And they
intelligent lighting and everything. They had
that
the curtains.
That was a whole Youngblood. He was the convention chair, and he did it for whatever reason. He liked me, and he built this thing.
What's not to like about you, man? You're one of the nice guys.
Thanks, thank you. I appreciate that. And he built it, and I walked into this room, and I was in shock. And it was a lot of fun, and the show went really, really well. And but yes, I did it, and I did it at the Pella Theater, also the castle. I was in the castle. What happened? It was in 2009, and I did the PCAM, and I had all my stuff. So I called up the castle, and they said, talk to Max, because Max was the booker, Max Maven. And Max, I spoke to him, and he goes, so what do you want to do? And I said, well, blah, 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 this is one. Is there any way I can get in? I'd like to perform at the castle. I have everything with me.
Yeah.
I had called Sean and said, is it okay? Because I'm working your convention. He goes, Eric, we're already sold out. So not a problem. Do what you want. And I appreciate you calling me in advance just to let me know. So anyway, I talked to Max. I told him what I want to do. And he goes, listen, here's the deal. I can't put you in rotation with the parlor and the close-up room because I said, okay. He goes, because it's too late.
Mm-hmm.
But we have a room downstairs called the Pella Theater, and it's empty right now, and we can put you in there. You can do whatever you want. You can do an hour. And
is this before they had really started booking that room?
That's before they put the Pella Theater in rotation, because now it's Thursday, Friday, Saturday,
exactly.
Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, fine. So I went there, and I did it, and we did all the publicity and everything, and it was going to be one show. Then they called me up. He goes, listen, can you do a second show? And I said, yeah, sure. I don't mind. and called me like a couple few days later, can you do a third show? So I did 3 one-hour shows in one day, you know, an hour and 10 minutes, you know, and I was like, okay, I did it. And it was exhausting, but man, first show went over okay, went well, but now I get the room. Second show went really well. And the last show was, I blew the roof off. I was so happy, man. I was exhausted.
Yeah.
But it was fulfilled. A happy exhaustion, you know, when you do well.
Yeah. Yeah. And so then you continued to do that. I mean, I know that you've been working like the Liberty Theater. Have you been working?
No, I haven't yet.
Oh.
And hopefully your prediction will come true.
Okay. What about Rhapsody Room?
I haven't
Rhapsody
yet.
Theater.
Yeah, and I haven't. Chicago, okay. No, I haven't. I was just recently in the Chicago Magic Lounge. I worked the I didn't know what the space looked like, and they have the two rooms.
Mm-hmm.
They have the big theater, and then they have the 654 Club.
Club. Right.
And I said, well, I know I can work the 654 Club without seeing it. So let me try that, and let me get, you know, see what the room is like. And I had a blast, and they couldn't have treated me better. They could not have treated me
Joey's before. Great.
Joey, Ben Barnes, everyone was super nice, and they couldn't have been nicer, and I had a blast. I put together a specific set for that room.
Yeah.
And was very happy with the response.
There's another theater, though, that you had worked that's just outside New York City.
It's called Sparta Avenue Stage.
Sparta, that's it.
Sparta, New Jersey, where my friend Joe Garcetti and his lovely bride, Diane Garcetti, they have a theater there that they built. It sits about 70 people, and I go there a lot.
Is that a four wall that you rent out basically from them?
No, it's with them. We just do a thing on the ticket sales.
Okay.
And I don't care. I just love them. They're like extended family, Joe and Diane. They're extended
family.
They
have other magicians work there? Or
yeah, they do. They just had Javi Benitez there this last week.
Oh, did they? Okay.
Yeah, they just had, he did a lecture in the afternoon and two shows in the evening. And he did extremely well. The audiences loved him. And they get lay people from the area. They get magicians sometimes. And I've performed there. And, you know, they let me come in like last year before coming here and doing my show.
Yeah.
I wanted to do a warm-up show there. And we sold the joint out. And the show went really well. So I felt confident coming here.
One of the things that has to do with ticket sales and also how do people butts in the seats, I guess, basically, because
you have to put butts in the seats.
But do you do it through using social media? Do you do that through?
I do it to social media. They have their social media. They have their mailing list. I have an old mailing list.
I'm just wondering about one-man shows. I mean, people who are listening to this who are saying, I'd love to have a one-man show, and okay, I know how to do it now. I'm going to do like what Eric's done is I'm going to work, you know, open mics, and I'm going to be starting to build that and put things in and out.
So
I get there, then how do I put people? I mean, that's a whole other thing. And
that's a whole other side. And that's the scary part, because once you start four-walling, you know, when I did, in 2007, when I did my show and produced it myself, I found a place in Manhattan, the Three West Club, and we turned this, they had a room called Lincoln Room, had a nice fireplace. It was a real parlor show, and a nice fireplace and whatnot, and they let me come in, and first we had like 40 seats, that we just put chairs in the room, and I had my performance table in front of the fireplace. And there's some great pictures of the show and the room. And eventually, as we were building up clients, I was able to figure out a way to get 53 seats in there, which is not easy because we were just cramming them in.
Yeah.
And it went over really well. And the biggest, and that was a 90-minute show with no intermission. The biggest compliment was, at one phase of the show, I have to walk off stage. I have to go walk up stage to go get something. I have an excuse for that. So I literally walk off. I play some music. I'll be right back, whatever. And I had people, because listen, it's over an hour. And I remember people looking at them going like, an hour? They couldn't believe they lost track of time.
Yeah.
That, Scott, is the biggest compliment that I ever got.
Sure.
Because
it was like— time disappears.
Right. That they were so engaged in what I was doing. And I had developed new routines for that and new pieces and worked out new solutions to old problems that I had. And it went over wonderful. And that's where the owner of the Metropolitan Room saw me and loved it and said, I got a great room for you to work. And I did like four runs there of 8 weeks each.
Wow. And so from here, do you have other kinds of
shows? Well, I'm working on a couple of things. I my life has changed. I'm a little older now. And
reaching retirement age?
Yeah, I'm. Yeah,
about that.
So I'm out of the full time job that I used to have. I was in the construction business for 42 mm-hmm. years. I know I don't look it. I know I look like I'm 32 years old. I get it. Don't have to say it. I know, and I act like I'm 12. I get it.
Got that male model look, you know?
Yeah, right. I gotta look for radio
for the. For the geriatric set. Say.
Yeah. So my goal is to see if I can find a home and to do my own little thing.
Well, there's senior living homes.
But yeah, that's funny. And I'm next weekend, the weekend after this year's Fectors, I'll be at the at Smoke and Mirrors Theater in Philadelphia. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's a great place. Marty Martin and
Danny Archer.
Danny Archer are just great hosts. The place is great for close-up magic. I can get to do certain things there that I can't do anywhere else.
Yeah.
So it's a lot of fun, and they're just great. And I get to visit my friends.
I know there are various theaters around the country and everything. In fact, my friend Scott Pepper in San Antonio has a place that he is just now selling, in fact, as we're recording this. He may have it sold by the time this is released, but he is moving to Colorado, and it's a great location right across from the Alamo. So it's got a prime tourist spot, and it's already got an audience that comes there on a regular basis and everything then too. It's just, he works cruise ships, and he's got a lot of other things that's kind of taken his time, and he's decided to, and his wife, to move to Colorado. Anyhow, he's looking to sell this place. But I know several other guys. I was talking to Keith Fields. He'd worked there, and some other people that we know have been there. I don't know if you knew about it. I'm trying to think what the name of the club is. But anyhow, he's trying to sell it. If someone's interested, they can contact me, and I'll put you in touch with Scott if he's still got it available by the time that this runs. I appreciate your time, and I thank you very much for, I kept speaking of an hour disappearing,
this has been a lot of fun. I appreciate it. It's always fun to visit with you, Scott, and we've known each other for a little while.
I've stayed at your place long before you were married.
That was a long time ago. Yeah, we both had darker hair.
Yeah, and I didn't have a beard, and man, times were different back then. So I want to thank you, and I want to ask about what your magic word is. What I always like to close my episodes with is asking my guests, what is it that's important to you? What's your philosophy of life, basically? It's not a word.
Clarity.
Clarity. Okay. So making sure that whenever that you're performing, that what is clear, not confusing, so you're kind of echoing I guess.
I have a nice compliment. When I was at the Chicago Magic Lounge, a gentleman who was into magic and designs magic and for Broadway shows was there came up to me after the show, and he goes, one thing about your performance tonight is that there is no doubt what the effect was.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big statement.
It
was clear that what the effect is and what you were trying to achieve. And thank you. Because I do spend a lot of time analyzing and trying to figure out a way to present things where that makes sense.
That is so very important, because that's something that, again, Vernon always was preaching about, saying, magic's not confusion. It should be very clear in what you're doing. And you were talking about the rising card. There was a card that was borrowed, and it's named, and it rose. Very easy to explain that.
Right.
Or other kinds of things that had happened in your show with the coins or the cone or whatever. I think that if a lay person were to have to describe your show and talk about the tricks, they could probably, within one sentence for each of the tricks, describe that without saying,
Thank you.
He counted down 13 cards, and then we add those together or whatever, kind of a thing. So it is very clear, and you keep things at a nice natural pace, so it doesn't seem like you're being rushed then either to keep that clear. Anyhow, excellent word, and excellent words also for this whole time, for this
pleasure here, always spending time with you.
I appreciate it. And so until next time, we'll have to leave it with you there. And you guys and gals who are listening to this, you might want to go back and listen to it a time or two again in the future. And I also recommend even going back and hearing Eric when we talked. I will have to look that up and tell you which episode it was and make a reference. But again, you can always go to themagicwordpodcast.com, and there's a search bar there. You can type in Eric DeCamps or about any other magician you can think of, and you can find them when they've been on the podcast. So Eric, thanks very much for being guest this week. So for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Eric DeCamps. Scotty out.
Thank you very much, Eric, for being my guest this week on the Magic Word Podcast. As you had mentioned, it's always nice to get together with me to talk. I feel there's a mutual respect there, in which I certainly enjoy getting a chance to visit with you whenever we can sit down. And this was just ideal that we could have one-on-one quality time together for an hour, and it was great. I hope the rest of you who are listening enjoyed that as much as I did. It was certainly a lot of fun, and I got a lot out of it. I hope you did as well, as far as learning some things in this. There were a lot of topics that were discovered as we talked about the doing a one-man show and everything else. Anyhow, thanks a lot, Eric. This was great. Look forward to our future visits together. This particular episode is being posted in advance of the date, actually, in which it is being broadcast, because I'm going to be heading to Los Angeles. Last week, you got to hear reports from Los Angeles and the Queen Mary when we were there for the Magic Collectors Expo, and I decided to stick around for another 10 days or so in order to make it to the banquet for the Academy of Magical Arts, that's the Magic Castle Awards Ceremony. As some of you know, I am receiving an award tomorrow night. That's going to be on the 17th what used to be the Ace Theater in downtown Los Angeles during that award ceremony. And I'm getting a special fellowship along with a couple of other great guys and good people who deserve to receive the awards as well. Plus, there are several other awards, obviously, that are given from the Magic Castle, including the Magician of the Year, Lecturer of the Year, et cetera, et cetera. And I am just so proud to have this award to be given to me. It's the pinnacle of my career, and it's nice that they recognize this. And anyhow, start to get kind of choked up. It really means a lot, because it's not just the Academy of Magical Arts, but it is you, the listener, who has gotten me to this point where I get that kind of recognition from my peers on an international level here through the Academy by getting the special fellowship. So I not only want to thank the AMA for giving me this award, but also for all of you for giving me the chance to come into your lives each week with these podcasts, and to for you to actually take the time you do to listen to them. And so I thank you all very much for listening. So the official award I'll be receiving will not be for, well, at least another 24 hours or so from the time this is posted, and I'm looking forward to it. And while I'm there, I will probably be recording some conversations with people. And certainly next week in the podcast, I will give you a little bit of insight and kind of behind the scenes, or at least kind of tell you my experience so I can kind of bring you along with me, so to speak, to give you that experience as much as I can, as close as I can. So again, thank you all for coming along on this journey. It's not over. I'm just kind of still driving this old jalopy. It's getting older every day. But I thank you for coming along on the journey with me, as I said, and I look forward to the many more years in the future of delivering this to you. Thanks again for listening, and thank you again very much, Eric, for being my guest this week. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember to have clarity. This is Scotty out.